This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A grain, all right.
It's going to tip the scale.
Just remember that, then.
That's a small bit of a needle there.
Come on, Mayo. You've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Listen, McLean. And now they're really roaring. And I can tell you, there won't be a cold milk cold declare for at least a week.
10 years ago, on the 15th of December 2012, Paddy O'Shea died suddenly at his home in Ardabohir, West Kerry. He was just 57 years of age. Paddy O'Shea is an iconic figure in the history of Gaelic football. His record as a player is incredible. He played 53 uninterrupted championship matches for Kerry and 84 league matches between 1974 and 1988. During that time, he won a joint record 8 All-Ireland senior football medals, 11 Munster senior football medals, 4 National League medals and 5 All-Star awards. In 10 All-Ireland final appearances, he conceded just one goal and 1 point to a direct opponent. Then, as manager of Kerry, he won 6 Munster finals, 2 All-Ireland titles and 1 National League. He also managed Westmead to the only Leinster Senior Football Championship in the county's history. However, to reduce the story of Paddy O'Shea to a roll call of his victories is obviously totally inadequate. He was a singular man, one of whom it can truly be said they broke the mould after he was made. My name is Paul Rouse and I'm here at the South County Bar in Douglas for this special edition of the Irish Examiner Gaelic Football Show. I'm joined here by the former Kerry footballer Tomás O'Shea, who is Paddy's nephew, by Paddy's long-term friend, fellow Gaeltacht and West Kerry clubmate Tomás O'Flaherty, and by his illustrious former teammate Mikey Sheehy, with whom he shared so much success in a Kerry jersey. Mikey, I'm going to start with you. How would you describe Paddy as a footballer?
Well, I suppose a lot of the stuff that you've said there, Paul, describes him. I think the one statistic that sticks out is what he conceded as a defender in all those All-Ireland finals. You know, an incredible player. And, like, Paddy was my man, his nephew here alongside me, was a great man to saunter up the field and kick scores. But if you check Paddy's record, he was an incredible man to bomb forward and score. And another thing I would say about him is that, you know, being with him, it is very hard to put a word on it, you know, but he was obviously an inspirational individual. Even though he was about 9 months younger than me, I actually always looked up to him, you know, because I came across him years ago. The first time I ever came across him was when we played the Sem, and I was playing with Tralee CBS, and we never beat the Sem, but he was always one of the men that did fierce damage to us. But even at that age, you could see that he was going to be a serious, serious operator. Also played Kerry minor football with him, and under 21. And I suppose I was probably, myself and himself, were the first two of, we'll say, Pat Spillane, Ogie Moore and Bomber and all those lads, to get on the Kerry senior panel. The two of us played together in a National League final in 1974. Against Roscommon, and it was funny. The two of us were rooming together, and in those days, we were staying in the Skyland Hotel on the Saturday night. There was no team meeting or nothing. You know, you could do what you wanted to do.
Dangerous enough territory.
Just a nice little story about Paddy was it? Like, I was the Townie, and he was, you know, the Westie. Like, but the role should have been reversed really, because he was far sharper than me. So we were kind of killing time on the Saturday night. Anyway, it was a beautiful April evening, I remember, and. He said, we'll go away for a walk. So we walked up to Whitehall, up towards Home Farm, and there was a soccer match on. And old Paddy would have no interest in soccer, but just to get time, he said, yeah, we'll go in and watch it. To some D'O'Leary Cup final or something that was on. So we spent about a half an hour inside, and we're bored. And this is about 8 o'clock, half 8, and we wandered back down there towards the Skyland. He says to me, like, and I was hardly taking a drink at all at the time. He was 19, I was 20. And he was far more seasoned at that than me at that stage. So he says to me, will we go for a pint? And I was kind of saying, Jeannie Mac, I don't know, but anyway. So we ended up in the Cat and Cage anyway. And my sum total of drink anyway, used to always be a pint of Smittix maybe with a good shot of lemonade. But that's all I was ill for. So next thing we went in and he didn't even let me call what. We have 2 pints of Harp there, he said to the barman. We had at least 4 if not 5 anyway. This is the night before National League final. And I remember going up to the room like, and I was, nice and happy, you're sure. It made no difference to your man. And the following day, we got on okay. We actually drew the game and won the replay. But he was just such a warm character, is what I call him as well, you know. And he was, as the boys will tell you, he was very roguish as well. But he had this thing in the dressing room as well, Paul. Now, I know I'm going off script a little bit with him, but he was just inspirational. He was a leader, you know.
Michal Mar-Hurtig said he epitomised the Kerry spirit in how he played football.
Yeah, probably a good description of him, you know. But he was like, his all-round skill level was quite exceptional as well, you know.
So you played the same side of the field as him most of...
I did, right full, so, and he was up right half-back, yeah.
So there must have been an understanding in terms of timing of runs, in terms of getting delivery of passes.
Oh, there would be. And, like, I mean, that came from training, you know, from hours of playing backs and forwards and whatever, and matches, AVB games. You would, and it is a thing that the chemistry kind of, I think it comes together, you know. You don't even have to plan and talk to a guy before a game. You know what run he's going to make. He'd know what run I was going to make, or if you weren't making it, he'd let you know that you weren't making it, you know. But he was just, you know, and another thing about him is that, you know, people would probably realise, like, Paddy was like, I know he worked as a guard for a number of years and he did different things, but he was like a professional footballer, you know. And, you know, he was often one of the fellas, and I was often in there myself, the fatties, as Mikko used to call us, you know, during, we'd say, early on in the championship when fellas weren't going well, and he reckoned he'd have to call in a certain number. Paddy was nearly always called in, but I really and truly couldn't understand why he was called in, because he was always in peak condition. And he was a fella that really didn't put on. I never saw him getting majorly overweight, you know, but I suppose Mikko knew that he was dipping the head into the bucket at that time. And I think Paddy actually would enjoy to be called in that bracket, but he was just an exceptional footballer, and I was very lucky to play with him.
Tomás Oblarda, you saw him play when you were young as well. From the very beginning, you saw him play underage football.
Yeah, well, I suppose the talk of the Gaeltacht at the time. I was only 9 years of age, and the talk of the Gaeltacht, there was a young lad coming through, and my first time seeing him was inside in Dingle. I got the CIA bus into Dingle when I was 9 years of age on one Saturday evening. And what I remember of him that evening was he was playing cornerback, 14 years of age, senior football, and he had the white collar. Gaeltacht had red and white jerseys that time, and he had the white collar up. And then 6 years later, I was playing on the Gaeltacht team with him, and he was off playing with Kerry then, but on Saturday evenings, before a championship game, you know, a Munster championship game or a Munster final, he'd ask me to go into Dingle with him, basically to kick the ball to him for about 20 minutes. So that went on for a number of years. And then I played with him with West Kerry, and then I played under him when he was manager of Kerry or West Kerry. And then I ended up in Westmeath with him later on again. So, yeah, he was there for a good bit of whatever I did in football.
And Tomás O'Shea, did you model how you played on Paddy, or was it something that was just it was in the air rather than something that was conscious?
I don't think so. No, I was never told to play whatever way. I think I started out as a forward, would you believe? And it was in first year in secondary school that I went up to the teacher and I asked, could I be swapped into the backs with another fellow who was playing wing back, who wanted to go up corner forward, so we swapped. So no, there was never a kind of a comparison made. You know, I think Paddy was very traditional in his own beliefs in the way the game should be played. You know, I think he loved going forward himself. But if I went forward 3 or 4 times in the game, he wouldn't be shy in telling me, stay back, you have no business up there. There's fellas up there that'll do it. You wouldn't answer him back. You'd like to have answered him back, but no, he was very traditionalist in the way he prepared teams, the way he wanted players to line out. You know, there was never tactics with him didn't go. If you were number 5, you weren't switched over to I think that was a big difference when Jack Connor came in. He switched defenders around to suit forwards. But I think, and it came from the great Kerry team, that you line out the way you line out, and that's it, and you pick up who comes your way, and that's it, and you sort them out. So yeah, there was no play like Paddy or whatever. I didn't, you see, outside of the footage, the lads would have played with him and played. I never saw him play towards the very end. Yeah. Yeah, I did towards the very end, yeah. Just as he was about trying to get back onto the Kerry team around 88, 89, that time when he retired. There was a big game inside in Dingle where there was an infamous clash, himself and Dennis Higgins, where Paddy came out and the two of them split themselves up. And I could hear the crack. I actually missed the actual incident, but I heard the crack. And I went into both restrooms, there was blood everywhere, but that was the end of it for him, because I'd say after that he kind of, you know, he was at an age where he knew he should have, he had to pack it in really, you know, but
I was actually playing in that game.
Yeah.
And and he was saying, what else could I do? You know, he had to crash into Dennis.
So what happened?
So
they ran into each other.
So the Gaeltacht were up a few points. It was a West Kerry League final. And he was playing fullback, marking Liam Higgins, a great friend of his. And there was nobody on this side of midfield. The ball broke loose. Dennis Higgins was going for the ball. Paddy decided, I have to get that ball, otherwise they have the game won. So he went, and the two of them head on 50 miles an hour,
yeah.
And they clashed. Paddy had to get, I think, 35 stitches in the ear or something afterwards. But after that, I think he found it very difficult to go in for a 50-50 ball with anybody. And it was shortly afterwards that he gave it up. But just going back before that, I went to the SEM for 1 year, around 1973.
Mm.
And Mikey, you might remember this.
Mm.
I don't know, they have some way in Kerry about identifying young lads coming through. But the talk in the SEM at the time was, who now would be Kerry future stars? And there was three guys that lads in the SEM used to talk about. Pat Spillane, who was no longer in the SEM at this stage, Paddy Shea, and Sean Walsh. They were the college stars at the time. And sure, look, they were right, you know.
They came true, in fairness.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
That it's interesting that a clash, so that clash kind of probably finished them to some extent in that career. But I saw an interview from 1980. It was an Irish language, a really brilliantly shot Irish language documentary from 1980, where Paddy was asked in Irish, was he dirty as a footballer? And he had a great answer for it. And he said, anything I do it when the football is around me. I wouldn't have the heart to do something if the ball wasn't around.
Mm.
And he kind of rejected that idea. But there's a clip on YouTube of himself and Dinny Allen having, exchanging gestures. Punches, an elbow and a punch from 75, and it kind of gives it, it doesn't seem to me to be a fair image of how he played.
I don't think so at all. And I suppose when Paddy was managing teams, what he'd say to lads is he had no time for this trash talk. He said, if you answer back or if you say something to fellas, you're letting them poke at you, and now you're getting weaker. So say nothing, go in for a heavy clash or whatever. But say nothing. Shake their hand at the beginning of the game. Say nothing. And be as tough as you can be in the game then.
Mm.
And he played it tough. But he wasn't, I don't think he was dirty. I know that he hit Denny Allen that time. And it's on YouTube. And
no, but you're spot on. Because I marked him a good few times. Now, all I will say, three or four times in county championship games. I was centre forward, usually with Stacks, and Paddy was centre back with West Kerry. Never got a dirty blow from him. No. Game was on when you had the ball, like, you know, and he was tough. But nah, never got a false blow off him. Got a good few false blows off a couple of other Kerry fellas.
How would he be inside in Killarney, marking Pat Spillane?
Oh, he'd be tough, but he'd do exactly in training what he'd do in a game. And I can remember one story actually. I think it was before the 1980 All Ireland final against Roscommon. Mico Dwyer, we used to always go for a kick around on the Saturday morning and then go for a bit of grub and then down to Mickey Docks and onto the train. And Mico would never, all you do was kick around, but this time Mico got a bit of a rush of blood to the head. And he said, we'll play 10 minutes of backs and forwards. And everything was kind of going nice and cagey. Fellas were, well, there was no physicality. Mikko did emphasize, look, don't do anything. Next thing, a ball broke between Paddy and Spillane, broke on the ground. And Spillane went down for it. Well, if he did, my man came in anyway, and he drew. Paddy was just in the zone. Drew on the ball. Next thing, all hell broke loose. Spillane, of course, being Spillane, he made a meal of it and was rolling around. And somebody said to Paddy after inside the dressing room, Jimmy Mackin. Paddy was saying, look, I'm in the zone. If that happens tomorrow, he said, am I going to stand back and let your man pick up the ball? I'm not, you know. So he was in the zone. So.
He trained the way he played.
Yeah, absolutely he did. Yeah.
Where did this come from, Tomás, this approach to the game? Like, he obviously, Mikey said earlier, but he was almost a full-time footballer after leaving the Guards, and possibly even when he was with the Guards, he probably did a fair bit of training and during work hours. But where did this obsession with football come from?
I don't know. He always had a fierce interest in the history of Kerry football and the old footballers and the old stories and the footballers of North Kerry and South Kerry and Paddy Bawn and Sidon Dingley. He had a great grow for that. He had a first cousin over the road, Tom Long. And like my dad and Tom played football, and Tom won an All-Ireland minor medal with Kerry. But they didn't have the drive or the focus or the attention or, I suppose, the selfishness that Paddy had. He was very driven in what he wanted. And from an early age, I think when he went to school, it was all football. He went to the same, Tom went to Dingle, my dad went to the same, but it wasn't, he didn't go to the same to learn. He went to the same because he knew the same was the nursery of football in Kerry and he wanted to go there. I think he was kicked out of the same as well.
I think he was.
He was kicked out of the same for reading dirty magazines.
when he went into, I suppose we saw him at home, and I remember seeing the likes of, because those lads were all heroes to us, and he just took it. He went into the Guards after, and that didn't suit him. He wanted to be at home. He was always home, even in later years, even if it was up the country on a late night, out or whatever, he'd have a driver with him, and always... Yeah, but he'd land home in his own bed. He wanted to be at home, so he was a home bird. But then you'd see the type of training he did. And I think you don't learn something by it being written down. You learn better, I think, if you see it being done. And the way he trained, because I didn't understand it at the time. It was summertime. You'd know it was summertime. We were off school, and the boys would be training inside on a Tuesday and a Thursday. But on a Monday and a Wednesday, he had a routine, and... Mikey was right, he was ahead of his time. He didn't care about work, so he'd get his sleep during the day. He would time it. But on those days off, and the Mikko trainings were legendary, apparently, how tough they were.
Paddy described them as sadistic.
Yeah, well, Mikey be the man to tell you. But he would, on the day off, he'd jog around Slayhead, which is about 13 miles, but he wouldn't go on the road. He'd go up to the top of the Clasach, over the top of the mountain, down into the graveyard and around Slayhead. And we'd have a job then of these hurls. There'd be about 10 hurls, and we'd bring them down the beach, and he'd set them up, and they'd be that high, and he'd jump them five in a row, and he'd go around and around. He'd jump into the tide and back up to the house. But everything, like Mikey said, he enjoyed the crack and all that, but I've never, and we've all been stuck in football, I've never seen anybody... take, and they'd see the funny side of Paddy and all that. Never seen anybody take football as serious as he took.
You used a very interesting word there in the middle of that. You said he was selfish.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, he put football ahead of everything. Everything, like work and family even, and you see that then. And it mightn't be healthy, you know. It's a selfishness that puts everything. Like, he would work. There was days I'd see, like, I used to work inside in the bar. You know, you go into the bar and he'd say, I'd be back in 10 minutes there. I'd be gone for 3.5 hours. But it was take it easy somewhere. He was just selfish. Everything was worked around football. And that was it. So if work was coming in the way, pack in the Guards, came home, took a lease on Cruisers, came across and then built his own place. He wanted his own place. He wanted it on the main road. But everything was you know, I remember he'd have the car, I'd say whatever, the car would be ready early and they'd go over. He was always a great man to be inside in training early. As a manager, I only saw him, but as a player, everything was geared towards Kerry. That was it, nothing. And that's the selfishness that I'm on about, like, you know. And he'd expect Kerry. That out of you then.
Yeah.
Do you know, if you were playing, and he was manager for us, we couldn't get away with it. When he actually left and Jack got in, we got away with a lot more. because we could go for a couple of jars back west or whatever. But when he was there, if you saw the car going in late at night, you've no business doing this or that, football number one, you know. So that's what it is. And it was over years and years you'd see it.
Was he? Would you put him as the most driven member of your famous team?
Well, he would have certainly been one of the most, Paul. Yeah, absolutely, totally. But you know, Tomás, it's a good point in being selfish. Like, I think that was one of the things that Mick O'Dwyer demanded of most people, and Paddy certainly was always doing that. But another thing about him was, like, I've listened to loads of people down through the years in dressing rooms. You know, probably the best man I've ever listened to would have been Mick, obviously, but next best would have been Paddy. You know, just the way he spoke. You know,
even when he was a player.
Oh, as a player, you know, he spoke like, and he, you know, he always spoke sense. He always wanted the betterment of the team. But no matter what players were doing, you know, if Paddy stood up and said a few words, everybody gave their attention to him straight away. And not a lot of people can do that, you know. But he was just a brilliant guy.
Did it come from home? From him, the drive and the football being number one, did it come from the house he grew up in?
I don't know. I don't think there was a huge tradition of football in the immediate family. My grandmother was Lavin, Beatrice Lavin from Sligo, and my grandfather Tommy came from the O'Shea's in Carra Trent, and there wasn't a huge tradition of football there. There was a bit of football in over the road in terms of his first cousin Tom Long had won All-Ireland's with Mick O'Connell and Dwyer and all them. But I think it just came because football is the number one sport in West Kerry, and there is nothing else, and there was nothing there at that time. And he was, my dad and Tom were born over in London, so he would have grown up. He was brought home, and there was a big age gap between them. But he was just reared fully locally, and it was just, there was a draw for Kerry football. I think that tradition had started from day one. In the 20s with Kerry, when they won the first four in a row, there was just a tradition in Kerry, and he was mad for that. He was just one of these.
He wanted to be a county.
He just wanted to be above anything else. And like, it's not like everybody we talking. It's not when I say that he was. I think everybody has to be selfish, and that great Kerry team were, you know, they were all driven. They had to be as successful as they were. Dwyer had to be driven, and I'm sure Dwyer and Mikey, they were all selfish like it. But
absolutely,
from our point of view, we saw what we saw was just pure, like those days that he used to train on the days off. I remember you'd see Tommy Doyle used to come back a good bit with him. I'd say he was mad enough to do the training, but it was phenomenal. Like there was, and then the banter side of it, he just had a great balance. He was supposed to train, he trained, and I think maybe, I don't know, he had it right, like, and he had it right for the teams. I remember just thinking there as you were talking, when he was manager, he used to get on famously with the players, but he would demand the same that he would do himself on the field. But on the off-season, I remember he came up, we were in college in Limerick, and he drove up one night, he brought us all out in the town, brought us for dinner, brought us for a few pints, and then as we were going for the nightclub, put a few bob in our pocket, and then headed off himself, left us off. But he was doing that everywhere. He'd make touch with parents. He had that extra touch, and I think that used to make it a huge difference to young lads. They'd go the extra yard for him, you know, and he had a relationship with them in the dressing room. But when it came to football, then it was cutthroat, and that's the way everybody knew it was with him. Like,
I suppose the other thing, you know, an example of that drive, that how ambitious he was for Kerry football. I think he had won 5 All-Irelands at this stage. So he had made the Kerry team, he had won 5 All-Irelands. So his next thinking then was he wanted to captain Kerry. So for him to captain Kerry, he'd have to win a county championship. And he was playing with West Kerry, who hadn't won a county championship since 1948. And they couldn't, there was 5 clubs, they couldn't get things right. So what did he do? He decided he was still playing with Kerry. He said he'd manage West Kerry. And they won the county championship. So
that's right,
he was captain of Kerry. That's how determined he was.
And did the club mean as much to him as the county?
I don't think so, really. No, I don't think so. Like, green and gold was everything to him. Everything, green and gold, going out with Kerry, up in Croke Park, bringing back Sam Maguire to Kerry. That was his main thing always. And everything was geared towards that, as Tomás would say. Like, I used to remember coming home on the bus from school in Dingle around Slayhead, once a January, and he'd be running around Slayhead at that time against the wind, up against the Atlantic. And that was him preparing for summer months in Páirc-Uí-Chaoimh or Killarney. So like, he was well prepared for it all.
It's very interesting, that space between when he finished playing and then became a manager, and what he did to become a manager. And he clearly wanted the Kerry job almost immediately after finishing playing, but he did the 21s and then managed West Kerry, went back to West Kerry, won another championship with West Kerry, and ended up being there. It's very difficult to see him settling for anything other than managing Kerry.
Yeah, I suppose they probably didn't trust him. You know, they thought he was a bit wild, maybe, and that he wasn't able
to. Was
that
unfair?
Of course it was. Yeah, for us, you know, that knew him, it was, because I was in the dressing room with him. You were in the dressing room with him. You know what he was like.
Absolutely.
That he was able to manage players, and that he was able to get results out of players. But eventually, they did give him the under-21 job with James McAllard, and they won an All-Ireland. And I think it was the following year, then 1996, that he managed Kerry for the first time, and they won a Munster final straight away.
Yeah, I think the first time he went for the under-21 job, he didn't get it. Would I be right or wrong on that?
He went for it once or twice.
Oh, he did. Yeah, he did. But you know something, Paul, another issue with him that you talk about, his determination. You know, and like, I mean, he always wanted to have his own bar, as Tomás said, back west, like, and there was a lot of objections to him for a number of years or whatever length of time he was trying, but he eventually got there, and then he progressed with, which I think his legacy is huge, with this tournament that he ran. I mean, Paddy was a very smart guy. He was, you know, as I said to you before in football terms, he was ahead of his time. He was the same as a businessman, you know. He was smart. Look at the money that his tournament generates back in West Kerry, and even some of it even comes into Tralee now with accommodation or whatever. It's a huge tournament, and there's teams coming from every part of the country and outside the country, and, you know, that's a huge credit to him.
There was an interview with him after he took up in Cruisers, and he took the lease there, and he basically said he was sick working for anybody else. He wanted to work for himself, that he was now his own boss, and he kind of set into that independence of spirit. Do you think he was a loner?
I don't know. I think he
was.
Fellow
who's so gregarious, it kind of sounds like a stupid question
think,
in a way. But
I remember his wife Mara said that he was naturally shy, but in his own, he didn't come across as that, you know.
Yes.
And as later years went on, he got more confidence, and I think the sport itself brought out confidence in him. But no, I don't think he was a loner. I think he had a certain vision in front of him, and when he got stuck into something, he would go at it 110% until it succeeded, and more often than not, it would. And I'd agree with what the lad said there, you know, in terms of the way he was perceived as being a wild man from the West with no kind of control, or that was very far from the truth. Like, there
was that an act?
It wasn't. I don't think it was an act. I think his passion came out in different ways, but inside in the dressing room, he wasn't throwing things off the walls or he wasn't anything like that. He just knew what buttons to press, when to press, and he got the most out of fellas. And fellas, when I say fellas, would go through the wall for him and bring out passion. It wasn't through roaring. It was through the relationships that he had. He had great relationships with people. And I think that was his biggest strength, was dealing with people and talking with people and coming around with people. Like, you know, he was a desperate rogue. I don't know why I'm thinking of Mark here. He was the uncle that, he was like a brother more than an uncle in that, you know, if we were doing something wrong, he'd join us more than tell us to stop. Do you know what I mean? So when we were 14 or 15, he'd throw the keys of the car, his own car. He used to always have a big, powerful Nissan, and he'd throw the car, keys of the car to us, and he'd let us take it off down the beach on our own. But he gave it to Mark one evening, and Mark tore off down the road, and Mark missed the corner and drove the car straight over the ditch into the bog. And he came back up, and he wasn't really afraid of telling Paddy. He was afraid of my parents' reaction. But Paddy said, "That's fine, we'll get it sorted." And he made a phone call, and they got it taken out, and they got it fixed up. But Paddy actually, Mark was, I'd say, about 15 at the time. Paddy blackmailed him for 4 months to work behind the bar.
So that had to be a payback.
Paddy saw the opportunity, and in the end, one day, he says, Mark, come on over to the bar. It's time to go work. No, I know I'm not going over. He says, come on now, Mark, come on. I don't care. I've told him, Paddy. He says, I told my parents what happened. He says, you wouldn't get lost. But he used to, he was on that level. I remember the pubs would be flat out, and we used to watch old matches on the video, and the Kerry Golden Years we used to have on repeat, and he'd love coming back, and we only had one video in the room, or in the house, and it was inside my mother's room, so we'd all be up in the bed, and he'd come back, and he'd have a bit of crack, but he'd throw on the matches, and he'd be telling stories throughout the thing, but he'd do anything but our work. It was working the bed, sheep on the floor, like, he'd be around the place. His work was walking around the bar. But like, he'd have us inside the bar, he'd have everybody else bar, himself inside the bar, like, but he'd be on the right side talking to fellas, so, yeah.
So he was a great businessman then, in that respect. Or was he?
Well, if he put his mind to it, like, do you know, I always say, you saw was kind of, when he actually died, I personally do think that he was always chasing something. You know, he was chasing football, and he was chasing management, and he was chasing success in Kerry, and then he went after it with Westmeath, and he was always chasing. He was still going up to Clare, and I think he had actually, in the end, he was focused the last few months before he died. He was focused on work. He was away calmer, and he was actually looking forward to his own family, and he wasn't chasing. He wasn't chasing a job. He wasn't chasing some other team. And then he died, like, but it was funny enough, the last few months of it, like, you know, he was focused on the tournament, but I think he was always chasing. He always wanted to be in the thick
that
of it, like.
Energy.
Yeah, he always wanted to be in the thick of it, like he did. We all have egos, but he had a fairly big ego as well. Like, he loved the old crack. He loved the banter. He loved he enjoyed it. He enjoyed being in the middle of it. He enjoyed the crack of it, you know.
His time as manager of Kerry was singular for the way it went, but it's also singular for the way it ended. So we'll come to the way it ended in time, but he was a success by any stretch of the imagination. He took a team that hadn't won an All-Ireland for more than a decade, won two All-Irelands, won a few Munsters, won a National League.
Yeah,
is that how you'd look at it?
Absolutely. You know, again, it was because of his determination and the way he was driven. Like, Kerry hadn't won in All-Ireland for 11 years, and like that's I don't want to sound big-headed about that, like, but that's a long time in Kerry, and it was a pressure job. But he, you know, he faced it. He loved the challenge, and he brought the boys on, and he was involved in 1996. They were beaten in the All-Ireland semi-final by Mayo. But the following year, 1997, it was, it was a tough battle, but they got over the line, and I think they were always going to win with him because he was that, you know, he was such a determined individual, and I suppose if you want to talk about the time then that he left. What year was it that he left?
2003.
Yeah. I thought it was handled poorly by the county board at the time. You know, I mean, you know, what he had given to Kerry and whatever. And, you know, the dirty linen was kind of aired in public, which I kind of felt it should have been handled better. And, you know, because that man had given so much to Kerry, so much to football. And it was a pity the way it ended. But to me, it would never diminish his legacy. Never. Absolutely never, you know.
When did you join the panel, Tomás?
97. I wasn't allowed to go. I was doing my leaving cert, but I wasn't allowed to go in until my leaving cert was done. And he used to actually, I won't say blackmail, but he'd kind of plum asked me to get inside the counter, and he'd be telling me, I'd be bringing you in for a trial now soon enough. But he did. I wasn't allowed in. I thought he was messing, but he did. He brought me in for a trial. And that time it was still the old system. It was Munster Championship, and then you only had the semi-final and the final. So I went in 97, just after they had won the Munster Championship, yeah.
And yourself, Mark and Dara were in there. Well, how did you feel that about the fact that he was your uncle managing the team? What did that create?
I suppose initially when I was young, I did, and I struggled the first game I ever had, I had a poor game with Kerry, and you'd learn a lot in that alone. And I was playing cornerback against Cork in 98. That was the first game, so that went pear-shaped that day for me, but the team won. And on they went to the last Kildare in the semi-final with Mikko. But it was never an issue, to be quite honest with you, because after that, you knew inside in the training and the matches that were going on that you had your position earned. It wasn't as if that you were in a place where you were struggling or people were questioning anything. It was never, ever an issue, but you just made sure that you weren't in a position like that. It was never discussed. I never discussed it with Dara. But, like, there was a desperate, I think it came from Paddy, like, I would, if I missed training or if I was late to training or if I was, I'd get a rap, like, you know, it was, you just didn't, there were certain things you didn't do and Kerry came before everything. So there was never, no, I didn't feel under pressure. I don't think maybe Mark, the first year was probably hard, but you were coming in as a young fella. You were coming into
trying to find your
a
way
seasoned
anyway.
Team, like the team I came into where I had won the All-Ireland the year before. You had the Eamon Breens and the Liam Flahertys and the Morris Fitzes with fellas like that were on the road a long time, and you'd learn from that as well. Like, but no, Paddy was never spoke about that. Never spoke about the pressure that you were under. In fairness, he was always good that way. You know,
did he feel pressure doing the job?
He probably did, but if he did, he wouldn't leave it out on us. Like, you know, he'd soak that up himself. He probably did. Like, you know, there was desperate. Mikey'd tell you. The boys would tell you that Kerry is a bad. No, he gave that famous quote about animals.
The animals, yeah. It's
but that's
kind
in
of
every club, Paul. Yeah. That's in every county in the country.
That's
you know,
not,
it's
that's not.
Not
just Kerry. It's not unique to Kerry.
But there are, like, you lose in Kerry and they'll come with you. And I think that's what killed him in 2003 was the fact that the idea or the thoughts were in Kerry that there was a good enough crop of players to be winning All-Irelands, and we didn't give an answer in 2001, we didn't give an answer in 2002, and we didn't. And look, Peter Keane felt the same thing. 3 years without winning, boom, that's the axe comes down, like. And, you know, it wasn't handled well. Do I have an issue with them changing manager? No, sure, we rode in behind Jack straight away after. There was never an issue. Could they have handled it better the way it came out and the way they went? Do you know, it's just messy, and Kerry would pride themselves in not being messy, so... but 2003, the fact that Tyrone, and you could argue, sure, how it took that great Dublin team to actually really beat that style of football, which was 10 years later. So you were asking, tactics didn't really come into it. And it took years after to nail, like, Tyrone weren't the end product at Donegal, where, for example, but they started off a thought process that made managers and coaches think, Jesus, if you don't have a set of players as good as another set of players, you can set up in a way that we freaking, you know, bait them, like, and make it way harder for them, you know. So it was, I'd say, at 2003, we didn't really have an issue. It was just messy, and it was messy from the...
What did Paddy think of Jack O'Connor?
Actually, he would have had great...
I
remember...
As a selector.
Yeah, I remember, and Jack wasn't... Jack wasn't a great, huge socializer. Jack would have his few pints, and but I remember Jack had a draw for the game as much as Paddy did. They were different characters. You know, Jack wouldn't have socialized with the players as much, but I think it was Paddy that brought Jack in first day as a selector. And after one of the All-Irelands, I remember walking across the road to the pub in the morning, and the two of them were inside drinking tea, discussing the game. And they had a couple of pints after that. But no, I don't think Paddy had a desperate issue with Jack coming in, taking the position. It was the next step because Jack had been successful with the 21s in Kerry, and he would have got on fine with him, you know. But there's always, like, there's no matter who you talk, depending who you talk to, they might say there's a rift between South Kerry and West Kerry and this fella and that fella. But at the end of the day, and I think it came from people like Dwyer, and Paddy learned from people like Dwyer, Kerry trumped everything. And at the end of the day, that was it. So it didn't matter who was in charge or who was playing or who was not playing, as long as Kerry won. Questions are only asked when Kerry are
when they lose. And Mike, are your group of players that the lads you won all of those All-Irelands were, are you close?
You know, funny, I would be close enough, you know, but wouldn't be living in each other's ears, I suppose. You know, a lot of us would meet up at golf outings nowadays, you know, but...
Because there would have been criticism.
Like, how do you mean?
Public enough criticism between different parts when different people were managers.
Oh, there would be. Well, that's a different thing. But going back to the team and the squad itself, I remember doing an interview with a journalist a number of years ago. and he had interviewed a lot of the Dublin fellas that we would have played against. And he made a very valid point to me. I was one of the last fellas that he interviewed, and he said, do you know, having interviewed both sets of players, he says, the one thing that I could gauge is that the Dublin fellas are far tighter than ye are off the field. And they would have been. We would have had cliques in our squad, like, no doubt. Now, they all would have got on well, but some cliques would have got on better with other cliques.
It's a big county too, isn't it?
It's a huge, but it is. Christ, it's a huge county. It is a huge county. No, it's a huge county. But the one thing I would say, and I suppose it was part of Mikko's greatness, that once we crossed the white line, no, they all pulled together, like. There was no cliques on the field, but there would have been cliques off the field. Like Paddy would have had, like, you know, you talk about cliques, like, we obviously, the Tralee fellas would have hung around together, the North Kerry fellas would have hung around together. Now we would all have socialised together as well at some stage, like. But there was only one guy that Paddy or that Pichet was close to, and close, really, really, really tight with, Tomás will know this, was Paddy Lynch. You know, and Paddy would be kind of nearly, you could say, an opposite, a very quiet kind of a fella, but would love to socialise, he'd be a great man. But himself and Paddy were, oh my God, they were very...
They got into trouble.
They got into trouble a few times. Well, the famous story was before the 78 All-Ireland semi-final, Saturday night, fever one, John Travolta. Oh, yeah. We used to have a team meeting at 10 o'clock in the Grand Hotel. The team meeting always on the Saturday night was, Nico, usually the weather was good, I think one night, We had to have it indoors. We'd walk down to the beach and Mick would do his bit of a chat below. Now, there was no tactics board or nothing. It was a touch of Brian Cody, win your own battle, and a few basic things about, you know, giving early ball or whatever, you know. But what was the point I was making there? I'm about to lose
Paddy Lynch. And
or Paddy.
Saturday Night Fever.
Saturday Night Fever. The boys went in anyway to Saturday Night Fever, and they claimed that the queue was too long, that they'd missed the meeting, so they decided they'd go to the bar for a couple of pints anyway. And God only knows how many pints they had. Now, some people say they had two or three, other people say that they had seven or eight. But I remember talking to Mikko Dwyer. Mikko actually came down on the Sunday night in the train with us, and most of the boys stayed in Dublin. After the game, we played Roscommon, and I'd say the three best players on the field was our half-back line the same day. It was a kind of a damp old squib day. But we played solid enough now, and Roscommon were physical enough as well. And, well, so had we plenty of physical fellas. But you had P.O., number five, the Horsey centre-back, and Paddy Lynch, left half-back. And Tim Kennelly, I can remember now, and he wasn't having a drink at the same time, but the boys, we'll say the three of them now, they'd be called, like, when they went on sessions, the Rat Pack. And I always remember the Horsey came in anyway, you know, and of course he was delighted. We were facing All Ireland final, and he came in, and Mikko came in the dressing room door after a few minutes later. He says, Mikko, I'll tell you one thing, you'll win nothing without the Rat Pack. He says, you know, the three boys, they were probably the three best players in the field. But going back to the famous Saturday Night Fever thing, the two boys anyway, Mikko Dwyer said to us, a few of the players quietly, that when the boys arrived back out from Dublin for the team meeting, he said, he knew straight away that Paddy Lynch had liquor. But he said he had no idea Pichet had liquor. No idea. But he didn't say a word. But when we went back training, now the two boys were definitely...
Can I stop you there? You Paddy told me what happened, all right?
Yeah.
So they went into Dublin.
Yeah.
From Malahide.
Taxi in from Malahide, yeah.
So they went to see Saturday Night Fever. There was a big long queue. Yeah. When they got to the door, the man said, full house. So they decided they'd walk down the street and buy an ice cream. But before they got to the shop, there was a pub. And they arrived out in the Grand Hotel about 2 o'clock in the morning. And who was sitting inside? Only Dwyer. And he dropped both of them.
Yeah.
And Paddy...
For an All-Ireland semi-final.
Yeah, and Paddy was awake all night. He says, I have to be playing in this game. What am I going to do to change this fella's mind? Yeah. So Mikko used to go to Mass every Sunday morning with a fella from South Kerry, Eric Murphy was his name. And Paddy decided he'd go to Mass. And Dwyer went to communion, and Paddy was standing at down at the bottom of the church, and he waited until everybody was almost finished with communion, and then he walked up. And he was walking down, making sure that Dwyer saw him. And seemingly Dwyer turned to Eric Murphy and he said to him, look down, John Travolta.
Paddy never let the truth.
No, he never does.
A good story.
No,
yeah. It always.
And he got playing.
It is.
The manner, he was a different man though was he after he left the Kerry job? Did it knock him? Was it a big knock on him?
I think it was the way it ended. It wasn't the actual incident and the way it was handled at the very end. I think probably the fact that he had lost against Armagh, he had lost against Meath, he had lost against Tyrone. And I think that grated with him because he wanted, beyond anything else, to be a success with Kerry. And Kerry was number one for him. And the fact that he didn't go out, he wanted another chance. That's why he was disgusted when he wanted to get back in.
And he did that famous one finger at the press conference.
That he wanted another year. So I think that's what ate at him. And I'd say the fact that there was closure on that then, I'd say it was hard on him. I remember he got upset with us one day and he said, I couldn't manage anybody else. I wouldn't have the stomach for it. And 2 weeks later, he was above him. Westmeath recovered. But I think that journey with Westmeath lifted him. They won the Leinster Championship. But I don't know what, in my gut, I don't think he wanted to meet Kerry. I don't know, was that his, obviously he'd come up himself after that and approach that whatever way he had to, but I'd say it suited him to have the Leinster Championship pushed with Westmeath, which was historic. But then I think we were next, and I think Derry had beat Westmeath after that, and we played Derry then after that, so it would have been, I'd say that would have been difficult.
Because the system had just changed, hadn't it?
Yeah, the backdoor system.
I think it was his greatest achievement in management terms to win a Leinster Championship with Westmeath. Many people have won All-Irelands with Kerry. Mm-hmm. Nobody else has won the Leinster Championship with Westmeath. And you were there for that, Tomás. What was that like?
I suppose the way it started really was, he was approached by somebody from Westmeath, and he signed up with them anyway, all right? And then he came to Dublin. One day he asked me to meet him. He was at the Fáilte Ireland meeting, and he asked me would I go down on Saturday night to Westmeath with him to pick a few selectors. And she said, I didn't know how to pick a selector. What do you do? So anyway, we went to the event down. It was a charity event run by Goal. And I was at the table down there, and he was asking some fella to be a selector with him, and he said no, and Paddy was disgusted with this. You know, how could a fella say no to a man with 8 All-Ireland medals, Paddy Shea? So anyway, somebody, I think it was Joe Connolly, was actually at the table, and he was asking
me. The Galway hurler.
Yeah, he was asking me, why don't you go in as selector with him? And sure. Said, I have no idea how to work with an inter-county team. But anyway, a few days later, I got a call from Paddy, and he asked me, Jesus, will you become a selector? You can train the team. I'll give you full run of how to everything, he said. So I was saying, Jesus, Paddy, I wouldn't have time to go down. I'm really busy with work, and sure, I wouldn't be in time for...
You were living in Dublin. You were living in Dublin at this stage, yeah.
So he was at me for about a week. And I was saying no to him. Really, I was afraid to ask them in the bank for permission because I'd have to go off early. Until Dara rang me one night. And Dara said to me in the end, look, I don't care what you do, he says, but all I'd say to you is, if you go with him, you'll have two of the best years ever. And that was it. I went into my boss the following day. It was agreed. He let me off every evening to go off training with or train the team or whatever. And that's how it started. And I'm sure he was always full of ideas. Like the first time we met the team, we played a game in Dublin. We let Jack Cooney and Paddy Collins pick the team that day. And we met the team in the City West Hotel. We had never seen them before. We played the Dubs. And myself and Paddy sat on the bench that day. Paddy was wearing this, like an undertaker's coat, a big long navy coat, and Jesus, Westmeath, they were, you know, the word that comes after useless. That's how bad they were that day. Yeah. And Paddy turned to me at one stage and he says, Jesus, what did we leave ourselves in here for? And it was, they were terrible. But then he got on to Mick McCarthy, the Irish football manager. He was with Sunderland at the time, and we went over to Sunderland the following weekend for a training session. And then we came back, and he got these loads, tons of sand to put down on the side of the pitch to train. And we spent the winter training in that. Oh my God, it was ferocious. But the way that he wanted to operate the whole thing was that he wanted me to do all the physical work with him. And the way he said it was, what I want you to do is, I don't give a fiddlers about the National League, he said, but have them ready for the championship for me. So you work on everything below the neck. And when you have them right for me, then I'll work on everything above the neck. That's basically the way it happened.
But he was a folk hero almost immediately in Westmeath, even from the Auburn Cup. The crowd was, I remember Mullingar, 10,000 people having a Auburn Cup match in, it must have been January.
Yeah, he was very enthusiastic at the beginning. He had loads of ideas, and the first game that we had, and again, then he was very pishogach. Like, before the first Auburn Cup game, we went for a walk, the two of us, that morning. We stayed in a hotel up there, and we went for a walk in the morning, and we saw this goat, a black and white goat. Paddy had never seen a black and white goat before. So we went to the game, and the place was thronged, and they all had come to see Paddy, of course. Anyway, we won the game. Following Saturday or Sunday morning, what will we do this morning, Paddy? Jesus, we better go and see that goat again. I think he's a lucky charm. And every day after that, we had to do the same thing. Go and see the goat first, and he'd be inside. And like, the crowd would be watching him walking up and down the sideline. And there was one day he had this big padded jacket on. And next thing, he threw it off. And the crowd went wild. And he sat down on the bench, and he says, Jesus, I thought I had left all this mayhem behind me in Kerry. And everything was going grand then, and we started the National League. But then something happened. He was missing from a few sessions and stuff like that. And I think what happened was, and Tomás touched on it a minute ago, it was Kerry. We were going to be playing Kerry in the National League. He was playing now, or he was managing now against the team that was his team, really. And the players were his players, and he couldn't face it. He just sat on the bench that day. He asked me to take charge that day. And that, I think that really got to him, because he started going missing for a few training sessions after that. And it really, really hurt him that he couldn't be with Kerry. And it was only then, when the league was finished, we won our last National League game. And it was only then, a few weeks later, the whole thing changed again. He arrived, he went out on the pitch, he was tugged out. He was out in a pair of shots, tugs, taking frees and stuff. And the whole thing changed then again.
Yeah.
But like, he was, again, going back to the ideas, and Tomás touched on it before as well, the relationship he had with players. He was great getting to know players and instilling belief in them. And the way that he did that, like, he brought them away to Inchidani before the first championship game. And then he went, and he was always talking to them about being steely tough. And then he went to the Canon Ó Fianacht in Dingle, who was an Irish scholar. And he asked him to get a word for him and get a phrase maybe for him about, so that he could say it to Westmeath lads about being steely tough. And the Canon came back to him, and he gave him a thing, Ig bola dar le dornif. And then with that, so it, that means hitting an oak tree with your fist. And then he went to Brian de Stack jeweler in Dingle, and he got this small piece of silver, and those words were inscribed in it. And he brought the team away then to Ross's Point one weekend, and he told them, that he had a gift for them, and he was going to make a presentation. But he built it all up. He started telling a story about his first All-Ireland final in 1975, that he was based in Templemore. And the plan was that the team would come to Dublin by train, and they would stop in Templemore, and there would be a big fanfare for him from the guards going off on the train. but he didn't want this at all. And it was playing at him, he said. And he went to the boss and he told them, look, I'm not happy at all with this. When I'm going to Croke Park the next day, I want to be leaving from my own home in Ventry. And when I pull that door after me, the last face I want to see is my mother's face. Now, it was fairly powerful, and he was only warming them up to this stage now. And then he told them about Igbola Darle Dorn, what that means. And he said to them, you know, these teams in Leinster now, Offaly, Dublin, Meath, when Westmeath came up against those guys before, when they got hit, the Westmeath guys folded. And then he explained Igbola Darle Dorn that what this means is when you are hitting a Westmeath man the next day in Croke Park, it's like hitting your fist off an oak tree. They'll bounce off you. You're so strong now, you're physically fit. And he put that belief into their head, and they felt that they were way stronger already. That's the way, I think that's what he did for them. They didn't have that belief before. He gave them a bit of direction. He instilled belief in them, and basically he was telling them that they were way better than they had actually thought.
And got to a Leinster final against Laois and in 2004. And in that match, Laois being trained by Mick O'Dwyer, which makes it all the more interesting, and have the game won, really, with a few minutes left, 3 points up, clearly the better team, and fold in the last few minutes, and it ends up a draw. What did he do after that to prepare Westmeath for the next day?
When we went into the dressing room, I know that the Laois were very happy, and Dwyer was really
smiling. Cock a hoop afterwards.
So the Westmeath lads went into the dressing room. They had the heads down. They were really disappointed with themselves. And no talk in the dressing room. And next thing, your man comes in, and he eats them. Fucking wins, goes through them. He said, what the hell are you like that for? Basically, he told them that, look, you did really well today for 65 minutes. We have to do it for 70 minutes next weekend. We are going to do it for 70 minutes, and we're going to have the cup going home with us. And he changed the mood in the dressing room straight away. And it was all on to next week then.
And you didn't train that week?
Well, the routine was that after the game, we'd go to a swimming pool, and then we'd go out to the Port Marnock Hotel for a meal, and we'd talk to them. I'd tell them what we do in training, and Paddy would work again for everything above the neck. And that week when we went in training, we, after all the grueling training that we had done during the winter, we told them then that nobody is allowed to run in training this week. And it was all about the talking and letting the body recover and being fresh again for next weekend. And you obviously saw the clip on YouTube about the grain of rice.
Yeah.
All of that, you know, that's what he was doing that week. Yeah. And he had them prepped again for next weekend, and, you know, they came home with the cup. And after that, one thing I remember from that night, you know, himself and Dwyer, you know, they were always, he says, Jesus, I can't get away from this fella anywhere, all through my life. This fella, he's always there. But that night, I remember him saying, Jesus, finally, I got one over that fucker.
But did it mean, like, what did it mean to him, though, to win with Westmeath? Like, was the Kerry was never really let go?
No, Kerry never let go. And I don't know if it really sunk in with him what he had achieved with them. They were, at the time, there was Westmeath, Wicklow, Fermanagh, and I think there was another county, and they had never actually won anything at senior football level.
Yeah, no provincial title.
So Westmeath had won at this time, and Paddy was the man that did it for them, really. And I don't know if he ever... His mind was always in Kerry. Even those times when we went into Croke Park in the bag, and he used to show it to me, he had a teddy bear in his bag all the time, a lucky charm. But the teddy bear, even though we were with Westmeath now, the teddy bear was dressed in green and gold.
Kerry football. And I don't think he could ever get away from that. Even when we'd be going into Croke Park on the bus coming from Malahide, I'd be sitting beside him and he'd ask me, how are you feeling? I'd say, I'm fine, Paddy. He'd say to me, Jesus, do you ever get excited? I could do with bicycle clips now. And then we'd go into Croke Park, we'd be driving in and he'd see the roof and he'd, you know, you'd see the shoulders moving straight away and he'd say, Jesus, I love this place. I'm at my best when I'm in here. And as you know, Paul, Tomás as well, he was at his best in there.
In Croke Park.
He was so comfortable in there. He knew that things worked for him in there. But the Kerry thing, it was only I left the bank in 2012 and I rang Paddy and I said to him, Paddy, we'll have to go and celebrate it. And he said, come down to Dingle and we'll go out. And it was in November 2012. And geez, I had a great day with him.
Yeah.
He was drinking pots of tea and he was talking about Westmeath and, you know, how did we get that out of them? I thought it was only then that he had realized what he had done. And he had some great stories about it. And he was telling, Jesus, I'm telling the story now against myself, but, you know, when things are tough at home with Tomás and Dara, or maybe they'd have a bad game or something like that, I try and lift the mood and I tell them the story about our game against Offaly in Croke Park. He always had a trouble. He had two problems in Westmeath. He couldn't recognize that. He could never remember their name, and he couldn't recognize them. He thought they all looked the same. Jesus, the Kerry fellas. It's very easy to recognize them. These fellas, they all look the same. But anyway, we came in after the first game, and after halftime against Offaly, and he had this habit when we came in the middle of the summer that the boys would take off their tops, they're sweating, he'd get a towel and he'd be rubbing them down and he'd be talking to them. And he was talking to this fella. And I went over to him and he was telling him, stay back, you're doing fine, don't be going forward, stay back. And I tapped him on the shoulder and he said to me, Fidey, Neil Cheshine Gimmerton, her party, he's not playing at all. He's one of the subs. He was Russell Casey. And he'd be telling the boys the story to get them going again.
Did you meet up in those after Paulie finished with Westmeath? Would you meet him regularly or would you?
Not regularly, but if he was in town, no. When I had an office in Denny Street in the latter years, and Dara was just down the road, Dara O'Shea. Working with auctioneering, we'd often meet him for a cup of tea, but we not often enough, you know, because I you know, you'd love his company. But going back to one other thing, as regards Pishogi, inside in the dressing room, like, he was probably the manager really at the time. He should have been, but he was thinking ahead. But he had this thing in his head: before every big game, he actually would have to do it just before Mikko said his few words. He'd come over, myself and John Egan, the great John Egan. He'd call the two of us. No, he thought we were the only two players who might go for goal. And he had this thing in his head, like, and he did it before every big game. He'd say, lads, look, early in the game, if you get a chance of a goal, take the point. He had this thing in his head, like, if the goalie saves it, he said, you're going to give those fellas energy. Take the point. And you're kind of vegan myself. And look, but he'd do it before every game. And that was, you know, but he was thinking like a manager.
Yeah,
you know.
He was thinking your game as well.
He would. No. He could have said to me, if you got a chance of a goal, you'd go for it.
He'd be completely wired up when he was playing. He was completely wired up.
He was
saying that they were playing in the North Ireland semi-final in Dublin one day, and he used to come out, the dressing room was between the canal and the Hogan at that stage, and he used to come out in a tunnel.
Yeah.
And he was the first man out with the ball anyway, and he was hopping coming out, and he was just ready to get onto the field, and the gate was locked, and he couldn't open it.
Yeah.
And he said he was going mad, trying to get out, playing the dubs. Mm. And John Egan, sorry, he got a tap on the shoulder, and he looked around, and it was John Egan, and he says, Paddy,
If I don't see you afterwards, I'll meet you in the cat and cage. And here he says, Jesus, I'm trying to break down the gate, and this fella, all the fellas that was going to destroy the Dubs, here he was, going to the cat and cage.
Yeah, it was another day. I'd say, I think it was 1979, like, he'd be hyper, like, and we're playing Dublin anyway. And Mikko was just about to say his few words, so we were all in the doing our going into the loop. Next thing, I was inside the Jacks anyway, and I came back out. And after being inside the Jacks for three or four times, the next thing anyway, I heard this roaring. And I says, Jimmy, I thought Mikko had started. But you just passed the old dressing room, the showers were on the left after coming out of the loo. Next thing, Tommy Dyle and Paddy inside. Paddy had him cut by the throat, right? And two Westies now. And Tommy Dyle had a stare in his eyes, I'm telling you. And I'm passing here and I'm stopping looking at it. And Paddy was sent in private, like, because Tommy Dyle was in the army and that was his nickname, Private. You're marking the dirtiest player on the Dublin team today. Yes, P.O., yes, P.O. He said, when you get near him before the game, he says, catch him, buddy, you know what, and don't let go till you hear a crack. Right, P.O., right, P.O. I went back into the loo again. I said, what is the Dublin going to say? Oh, that's so funny. They were just completely hyped.
Completely. Oh, my God. I, over the last couple of weeks, I've spent a lot of time looking at interviews and reading interviews and reading what Donald Keenan's book and other bits and pieces with him. I think I met Paddy briefly in the pub once, never didn't speak to him, it was hello, two sentences, nothing else. I think he's a very complicated man. Would you disagree with that?
Complicated enough myself to understand that I couldn't make that call on somebody else. I don't know, I think he had complicated. Mm. I suppose, look, he was driven. I think everybody who has the success, I suppose, that he's had and the life that he had, I suppose, I think you can describe everybody as complicated. He had difficulties like everybody else, you know. There was no doubt about that. But
I mean, that how interesting he is.
Yeah, I think, look, he was always interesting. And I think he as life went on, and I think there was two when he was switched on, he was driven, and then he used to enjoy himself and relax. And I think people had that. I have that mixture of him when he was the Kerry side of him, and then just his own personal character, which I think rubbed off on everybody. You know, the stories that people still talk about, and you go in anywhere and you tell 10,000 body stories, and that fun. He probably was, like, but sure, aren't we all? Like, you know, I do firmly believe we you'd miss him around the place. That would be the one thing. Like, he is, I think it's like, no, I remember, you know, anybody that, you know, we all go through it. Somebody dies, the whole dynamic changes, but the place behind is completely different. You know, the bar is different, everything is different. You know, you miss the character, you miss the welcome, you miss the fun and the banter and the trips and the car and all that crack. You know, it was, you know, he fitted so much into his own life when he was around the place. But everything, you know, anytime you remember him now, 'tis with fun. You know, it was like, I remember Tom was saying there that he wanted to leave the county from, instead of leaving from the guards above, that he wanted to go from home. I remember in 2009, we were lucky enough to be Cork in an All-Ireland final, and I was under pressure. I had to get home fast. And Dara, she's the two lads that spoke me around. Dara, after the game, I met Dara outside the palace, and then Dara says to me, he says, where are you going next? And this was just after the match, and the rest of the lads were on the bus, gone to the hotel, I'd say. But I says, I'm heading home. I'm heading to Cork. I'm going home. And he says to me, geez, I think, of course, very like Paddy, he says, I think you're after winning man of the match. You'd have to be up for that. Mm. You know what's on? Mm. I didn't get man of the match at all. Like, but he just wanted me around the place. So yeah. I stayed up. So the following morning when I wake up, I was definitely going to Cork. Definitely. So the lads all got on the bus to go for the train station. So I kind of said I'd work my way up through the town and get up to the train station. I wasn't too much of a rush as long as I got home. But the last station before the last bar before the train station for West Kerry people is the Merchant. Yeah. So I don't know, it was about 2 or 3 o'clock that I landed into the Merchant, and who was inside around the table? About 20 fellas and a sing song going on a party. So I sat down, I had a couple of drinks with them, and James Begley, the musician, And John Martin, the driver, was with him, his famous driver who could write a book himself, to be quite honest about it, to be a bestseller.
I can imagine.
But he said, I said to him, after a while, he says, where are you going? And I says, I'm going down in the train, I'm going to Cork. And he says, no way, are you carrying your own medal into Cork and carry your own medal home, go home. Didn't take much convincing me to jump into the car, and we had a trip down, which was very funny. He stayed off the motorway, and we drove down the back roads, and we were coming down through Tipperary, and as we were driving past this bar, he says, pull in there, he says, pull in. But I noticed it straight away. I was in the back seat with James Begley, and I noticed three BBC vans. Very strange in the middle of Tipperary to have three BBC vans in the car park. So in we went, and I copped it straight away. There was lights down the corner, and it was an interview with Shane McGowan down the corner. And I talk about Paddy with his ego. Paddy thought the whole world knew who he was, and in a fun way, in a light way.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
I could see
yeah.
this. But the man was being interviewed. He saw James Begley, the musician, and he jumped up when he saw Begley. McGowan did. And you could see the boys in the camera. Jesus Christ. So he went up and he met James, a big hug. And I could see, I was watching Paddy, I could see Paddy expecting Shane McGowan to say, hi, Paddy, how are you? Great to meet you. And I wasn't coming. So I was kind of smirking at this, and it was just going on 20, 30 seconds. And the next thing Paddy said, he'd take it. Shane, maybe he didn't see me. Yeah. Shane, Paddy, Shane, how are you? And your man totally blanked him.
Yeah.
There's half a pint left.
Yeah.
And Paddy turned to me, what on that we're leaving here. So we ended up in Inch that night singing songs, and we brought the medal home,
Brilliant.
He started that Monday, sorry Thomas, he started that Monday Boar's Head tradition of teams going there on the Monday after finals, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right, When I worked in the AIB in Capel Street. And during the day sometimes I'd get a phone call from Paddy. He says, come down to my office. And I had to go down to what the Boar said to him. But carrying on to what you said there, when Paddy used to go up to watch the boys play in games in Croke Park, on the Monday he used to go to the Boar's Head. And obviously he used to call the lads in, Tomás and Darren Mark, and they'd be in. And that's how that tradition started. And he told Hugh that you were nothing until I put you on the map. And that's how everybody goes to the Boar's Head now on Monday after
the
All-Ireland.
He was his first customer in 1994, he told me. First man in the door.
Yeah. But the other thing, Jesus, the speeches he used, given the dressing rooms with the Westmeath lads. There'd be lads, county board officials in there. They used to have tears coming down their face with emotion. And I'm only wondering now, what it was, if he was able to do that with Westmeath, what was it like when there'd be green and gold jerseys around him inside down the Páirc Uí Chaoimh?
It was very, I'd say what Paddy used to bring with him was what he saw with Dwyer and that passion. And I'd say he learned to pile, for he had to learn, and his own personality came out in it. But it was completely, he was just driven going into places, and you could see him, he was so tuned in. There was nobody more tuned in than him when we'd land in. I used to love going to Páirc Uí Chaoimh with him, because in Páirc Uí Chaoimh, the old Páirc Uí Chaoimh, they have a fantastic stadium, but the old Páirc Uí Chaoimh, the dressing rooms were the tiniest dressing rooms for the visiting teams that you'd ever come across. Literally, you wouldn't fit 10 grown men inside them, and there was 30 of us inside them. And I remember you'd have to come out, and you'd have to come through the tunnel where all the people were, so they'd stop the people, and they'd make the gap, and then the players would come out. It was a brilliant pitch to play in, but he was always tuned in. The weeks before, it was always the week of the game that he would really tune in, and that give chats on the field inside in the dressing room, but he was as passionate. So that's the he was sharp, he was a way more clever and a way more intelligent than people gave him credit for.
I think that's what I meant when I asked you about it being complicated, because there's that image, there's the image that he portrayed, and then there's obviously this whole depth behind him of things that he was involved in. We haven't talked about politics.
He was very clever in how to work. Even with Westmeath, it's a funny story, should I say it, but he was so well clued in like in terms of working, he would come down and he would write letters, personal letters to people, and he knew how to ask the right questions, who to talk to. He would mingle with the right people all the time, and he would be fun. He knew his place. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he could lean on fellas then for advice and all that. I remember Frank Murphy, and we're in Cork at the moment, and a great GA man, and has done all of us Kerry fellas favours down the years in terms of advice and in terms of everything else. But I know with Westmeath, a big bugbear by the GA at the time was that you couldn't encroach the pitch. And there was a rule brought in, so there was some guy above in the stadium and they were looking down, and if you crossed the pitch you would pick up a suspension or a match suspension or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But I think he picked up a suspension anyway, and he went to Frank and he said, Frank, look, this is ridiculous. I came onto the pitch here and you sorted out for me. And Paddy's initial suspension was cut out. But when Paddy would go on holidays and the lads went on a great trip to South Africa, Paddy would tail away on his own. And I heard Mihal O'Shea, the radio commentator, saying that you'd get a postcard and he'd make sure it was the most embarrassing postcard that you would get into the post.
Yeah.
But after that, he went and he got a postcard and he sent it to Frank Murphy. And what the postcard was a picture of a lady on a tennis court, and she was topless and it was over the line. And he put on the back, he called Frank Princess. It says, Princess, they wouldn't do this girl for crossing the line. And that's all he was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
But he, you know, always kind of make sure it was very embarrassing. I'd say Taoiseachs of the day used to get the most embarrassing postcard in there.
Well, I used to get them in the bank, and most of the managers working with me, they were all women. And I'd get, Tomas, there's a card here for you.
Which is funny, Paul, you're talking about the compassionate side of him as well. My father died in 2004. You were out in Lanzarote in a training camp, I'd say, weren't you, in January? And P.O. was at the funeral anyway, and he was buried on the Monday or the Tuesday. And next thing, on the Thursday, my mother got this most beautiful letter written from Paddy. You know, his handwriting was worse than mine, but the letter, the contents of it were absolutely unbelievable, and it made such a difference to my mother that he would actually, you know, he had been at the funeral, and that this arrived in on the Thursday, like addressed personally to her, you know, and about my father. It was such a nice touch. Yeah,
yeah, that's something that, that would,
incredible. Yeah.
That would live true. I wanted to talk as well about tickets. He was a great man for tickets, but we're going to leave that. We're going to leave those things. Mikey, I want to leave the last word to you. We started with the footballer. I want to finish with the footballer. Is there a game that stands out for you that Paddy played in that you think is a kind of an iconic statement of what he was like? Or is there a particular match? Or is it more of a run of games?
Jeez, I'd say a run of games. But one of the games that he was outstanding in, would you believe it, was the 1982 final against the
Offaly. He was brilliant that day.
He was outstanding. You know, and I felt for him that day, and for John Egan, who had a brilliant game as well, and who was the captain of the team, and who would have been the best captain we've ever had to lead us to five in a row. But Paddy was incredible. I think he kicked 2 points from wing back the same day. It was outstanding. But as I said, Paul, you could pick a load of games. I don't think there was ever any game. And I mean, your statistic initially, that there was only 1-1 kicked off him in how many All-Ireland finals?
10 or 11 All-Ireland finals.
That's absolutely incredible. But there's no, you know, sometimes you'd say, oh my God, such a fellow was poor. I don't think there's ever any game that I could look back on that I played with him and say that Paddy had a stinker. I don't think he ever had.
We could do this as a mini-series. Although we couldn't really, because it's amazing how many people have told me stories in the last 2 weeks. Now, I can't really tell you, you can't really use this one, but like there's a world of anecdotes around Paddy that kind of, I suppose, give you a way into his life.
I think one other thing before you finish, Paul, is, you know, when he used to be giving the speeches, you know, before a game or whatever, and he'd be on full flow, and next thing he'd stop, the word wouldn't come out in English. And he'd bring it out in Irish. He'd say it in Irish. And I think that's one thing with Paddy as well. You know, when he took over the bar in Kruger's, that he got really fond of the Irish language. He was listening to people from the Blasket Islands.
I was going to say, is that the group of people who
were from the Glasgow region.
Yeah, like the likes of Shining Vickle and Foyley and Chanfat's Tam and all those. And Paddy was a great storyteller. And I think he picked it up because they were great storytellers and they had fantastic Irish. And he learned a lot of Irish from them, the bloss and the storytelling aspect of it. And, you know, when he'd go to Dublin and meet these film stars and politicians, he'd be telling them stories about these lads from Dunquin. And I think that was a big part of everything for him as well, because when he was drawing people to Counthraw or to West Kerry with the football tournaments and bringing tourists to the place, he was able to... He was interested in the heritage of the place and the history of the place. And I think that was a big part of him as well.
Yes. And he changed his name, the spelling of his name, in the mid-80s. I saw that because if you look at the original programs, it was P-A-U-D-I-E. Mm. And O'Shea spelt anglicized way. Yeah. And then it was changed, really, in the middle of it.
Yeah, I never heard that discussed, but I know he did.
Yeah.
And my mother actually did the same. She rang the newspapers and told them that they were spelling Dara's name wrong as well. Which was strange, yeah, because it was spelled D-A-R-A. Canada was spelled that way. But
yeah,
I remember old programs because my grandmother used to keep all the old programs and all. Like Paddy was the king in the house, and she used to have a room above in her own house full. I mean, top wardrobes full, bed. Everything, the room was full, and you go up, and I used to love reading the old clips of matches and big games, and the build up to the All-Ireland finals was nearly more interesting than the report after. You'd have the pictures. I used to love looking at the pictures and the footage of training
or
pictures inside with the boys. But yeah, that was there as well, yeah.
Do you think, so you're what one of four brothers, which of you was most like Paddy?
Ah, oh, Jesus, hopefully no one. I don't know. I like Dara's a great character, you know, you'd always have a laugh, but it was probably bits in everybody, you know, because Mikey said something there. There was a part of him that was soft, there was a part of him that was conscientious, there was a part of him that would think of something that nobody else would think of. So I don't know. I haven't a clue, really. You know, there's, I'd be quiet enough, you know, compared to the rest of them. But look, I think the mold was broken when they made Paddy, and I don't think there'll be ever anybody like him again.
Yeah. I don't think there's a better way to finish than that. Thank you to Larry Ryan for running this podcast, to Raf Rocca, to Sam Abubakar, and to Daniel Anaba for doing the sound today, to Tony Lean, to everyone at Examiner Sports. A huge thanks to Tomás O'Shea, Tomás O'Flaherty, and to Mikey Sheehy for coming here today to the South County. Beamish Hernashka Lua.
A grain of rice. A grain of rice is going to tip the scale. Just remember that, Clem.
There's a small bit of a needle there.
Come on,
Mayo. You've got to get Andy Moran into the game.
Listen between them, and now they're really roaring. And I can tell you, that there won't be a cold milk I'll declare for at least a week.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.